Hey everybody, JJ Cooper, John Mioli here. Another of the Baseball America Prospect Podcast deep dives, and today we are diving in to the Baltimore Orioles farm system. John does the Orioles top 30 for us. John, great to see you as always, and talk about a fascinating offseason. A fascinating season last year, not in the way that the Orioles would have liked, but it was from the outside at least. It was fascinating. And then an offseason that I would say was fascinating in some ways that probably more Orioles fans, some like, and probably some are still a little bit skeptical about, but a big, significant offseason, big free agent signings, big trades, big moves. And still, as we're sitting here recording this during spring training, a whole lot of, okay, how is everything going to shake out, I would say, at the same time. But great to see you kind of take me through like what the offseason like was like. You know, someone following this team, it felt like that there was twists, turns, and everything in between.
Yeah. I mean, we got a lot of, you know, even from the 2024 playoff exit, you know, Mike Elias said they were going to do a lot of soul searching as to why they kept getting swept out of the playoffs and what they were going to do to change it. That line came back after he fired Brandon Hyde in May. So I've been on high alert basically for the last year and a half about, okay, like what is actually going to be different? And it started basically the day after the season ended. He said at his end of season press conference that he wanted the Orioles to be a team that people thought, like people like you and I, people who write about, talk about, are around baseball, inside baseball, obviously, people in front offices and his period. He wanted the Orioles to be a team that people thought could win the AL East. And they were not that kind of team last year. So just the idea that he wanted that to be the case, and this is something I've latched on to pretty early on, just that he wanted that to be the case. This is a front office that has done a lot of unpopular things and done things their way and put their blinders on and done what they thought was best to have an offseason where people would think this team that was one of the most disappointing probably ever in baseball would be a team that could win a division that is sending teams to the World Series pretty regularly. You have to do a lot of big stuff. You have to do splashy stuff. So I thought there was only one way for him to fulfill that. And I was kind of wondering how that would happen. And then they went out and traded Grace Rodriguez for Taylor Ward. They go out and sign Rand Helsley as their closer before the closer market starts. They miss out on Kyle Schwarber and they pivot to Pete Alonso. And all of a sudden they have their marquee free agent. They've kept, and then as if that all wasn't crazy enough, they do what people have done for, been asking them to do for the better part of this decade and package a bunch of prospects for a controllable starting pitcher in Shane Boz. And all of a sudden you have an offseason that's completely outside of their norm. And you have one, you know, we're splitting hairs over a couple of projected wins. Nobody's going to bat an eye if you say this team can compete at the top of the AL East, which makes them one of the best teams in the American League by extension. So he started out, he laid the marker down. And I think that in a way that's very unfamiliar to people around here in Baltimore, He kind of met that challenge.
It, again, we will get more into it as we go along. But speaking of that, they also do have, we saw at the end of last season, it's the Orioles. There's going to be arrivals. But the arrivals the end of last season, one of them was one of the most anticipated in a while. Samuel Basayo is the number one. The question we always start this with is, how difficult was the decision? This one's an easy one, I imagine. Even though Dylan Beavers had a great, you know, great arrival and all that, great breakout season in 25. But Samuel Basayo, if you're an Orioles fan listening to this and you're saying, I've heard a lot about prospects and what is Heston Kjerstad doing, and I'm still not sure about Colton Cowser and Kobe Mayo doesn't have a, you know, established job and all that. Samuel Basayo fits in kind of, I would say, that tier of, if it doesn't work out for him, I'll be shocked, because maybe he's not a catcher. We'll see. I think he might be able to catch, but as far as a hitter, as far as doing damage, especially at the age he is right now, there's a lot here to like, isn't there?
There's a ton here to like, and that was the separator that you know, I think talent wise, you could make the case just straight up on tools and projection, but he's above Dylan Beavers, but he is so young. He's so precocious. I mean, we're talking about the types of performances, the types of kind of precedents that, you know, handfuls of guys, like only a handful of guys do what he did in the minors and move as quickly as he did and slug as much as he did at the ages and levels he did. Like a handful of guys will do that over the course of a decade. And for the Orioles to have kind of pushed that along and let him stay in the places he needed to stay and let him move quickly in the places he needed to move quickly from, it really speaks to a good understanding of him as a player, him as a prospect, as a person. I think back to this time last year, and we would be coming off a year when he spent most of the year at AA, and people, you know, we're talking about him struggling, and it was like an 800 OPS. It was like most people his age and his profile are not doing that at that level, and that was a quote unquote bad year for him. So, you know, I think there might have been a little bit, you know, if you were grading solely and evaluating solely based on what happened in the big leagues, you know, Dylan Beavers was kind of just let loose and allowed to play and played freely. I think given the PPI incentives, Samuel Basayo was very clearly on an at bat count, and I think when you only get to play every other day and you know you're only going to get a certain amount of at bats and you're that age and trying to make an impression even with the contract extension already locked in, it's hard to produce that way. He's having his first healthy spring training in years, and I'm pretty fascinated to see how he is fit into this lineup, because whether it's behind the plate at DH, there's going to be a need for him, and he's the kind of guy where if this starts out well, it's not going to stop going well.
That's the next question I want to ask with it, which is, okay, obviously we know right now they do not need Samuel Basayo to catch 130 games this year. There's no scenario that's a good one for the Orioles. Like, Adley Rutschman is still here. Yes, yeah. I know Adley Rutschman did not have the season that anyone, including Adley Rutschman, wanted to have last year, but this at most would be, I would imagine, a job share and probably one where Adley catches the majority of the games. But how much, like, when I watched Basayo, when I talked to people last year, I do want to emphasize, I don't feel like that this is one of those things where you have the bat first catcher who everyone says, yeah, he might be able to catch, but then they, you know, under their breath are like, oh, he's never going to catch. This is a guy who, what do you think the chances are that Samuel Basayo is a short-term catcher? And then what do you think the chances are that he's a long-term catcher?
You know, I think if he catches a third of the games this year, and that's being, you know, that's a little less, that's somewhere between catching like two turns out of the rotation and one turn, more likely two, that feels fine to me. I think he's adequate at it. One thing the Orioles seemed to have kind of latched onto last year was he seemed to have a good rapport with Trevor Rogers. So I'm not sure we're going to go like a personal catcher situation, but you know, that's a day that could, if they wanted to do that and kind of keep down that road, that would be a really easy way to ensure he's catching at least one day. I don't think there's anything about his skills that would say that he can't catch a couple days a week in the big leagues. Now he is a mammoth human being and
like the most human being.
He's massive. And I don't mean that in a bad way. You know, that profile is not one that you see staying behind home plate for a long time. I don't think there's anything to say that he's going to outgrow it quickly. I think it's just kind of something you assume will happen. That said, if he puts his mind to saying, I don't care, I'm just going to stay behind the plate, like, he's this kind of person that's going to do it. But as you're talking about that, you know, there is nothing more dangerous as a concept than like when evaluators or people around the game tell you that a catcher is getting better in the minors. It's like, well, of course they're working hard at it every single day. You know, I'm sure if I've heard it like a handful of times about a handful of guys, you've heard it 100 times about hundreds of guys. It's like, it's such a hard thing it's a hard thing to not believe, but it can mean so many different things. And I think especially now the Orioles have, you know, Craig Albert as a former catcher all the way up to AAA in the Rays system. I'm Joe Singley is their catching instructor. He is very well regarded in terms of what he's able to do, like on the technical side, catching wise. And then Hank Conger is on the coaching staff as well. And then there's a lot of people who are going to be working with them. And I think there's also going to be an incentive to catch him because Adley Rutschman has worn down basically each of the last three seasons. And the less he catches, the better he's going to be long-term.
The other thing I would say with that is if you want to get beside this bat in the lineup, I mean, obviously he's going to DH some, but first base, which is somewhere that had been talked about in the past, like maybe you could play some first base. Pete Alonso, if he's healthy, Pete Alonso does not leave the field. Like, we have seen this. I know he's getting a little older, but Pete Alonso prides himself that when the season's over, there's a 1-6, you know, and the game's played starts with 1-6. It may be 1-6-0, 1-6-1, 1-6-2, but he's not someone who's like, oh, I'm going to take a day off every other week or anything like that. Obviously, they have Ryan Mountcastle. They have a bazillion outfielders. They have Kobe Mayo. The point being is if he we both think that he's going to catch. If he can't catch, then all of a sudden at-bats, not either for him or someone else, become a lot more scarce because there's a lot of guys, there's a lot of mouths to feed that they're trying to figure out how they all fit in that lineup, I would imagine.
Oh yeah. I mean, Kobe Mayo has been playing basically, I'm home now. I was there for the first week of spring training. Kobe Mayo was playing exclusively third base after basically giving up the position in the middle of last season. You know, I didn't see Sam Albisayo doing any first base work. So it seems like their solution to that problem is to just run in the other direction and say, we don't have too many people who are first base DHs. Look, this guy's a third baseman. This guy's a catcher. And that's not to say that none of those things are true, but, you know, they went through the offseason. There's a lot of guys, you know, I think some of the names you mentioned are, you know, in Ryan Mountcastle and Kobe Mayo. You wonder where their spot's going to be, given that Pete Alonso is now here, given Sam Albisayo and Adley Rutschman are going to be in lineup as DHs when they're not catching, and you wonder how it's going to work. Baseball has a way of giving you opportunities to figure that out in ways you can't even imagine. The first week of Orioles camp, Jordan Westberg and Jackson Holliday go down, and all of a sudden, Kobe Mayo, you are now a third baseman, and let's figure out a way to get all these guys in the lineup.
And that actually kind of ties into our next question, which is, how's the system better or worse than last year? And one of the things that has happened with this system right now is a lot of these guys have graduated. You just hit it. With Mayo, I feel like that this is, I don't want to say the last opportunity, but this is the opportunity, if he's ever going to be a third baseman, and I don't, Westberg, when Westberg's healthy, is going to be a better third baseman, probably defensively. But this is his chance to hit and show he can, you know, he's got this window here where it's like, better claim it, because if not, then I think that window gets that it becomes a very narrow opening pretty quickly. Because once he's back, once Holiday's back, we just talked about it, there's not exactly a whole lot of first base opportunities there. And by the way, Mayo, not that Mayo had actually shown yet that you could be really comfortable putting him there, over there at first base. That was still a question too. When you look at this organization as a whole, how is it different? How has it changed over the last year?
It is definitely less top heavy. I'm trying to think back to the top. I mean, I imagine the top handful of guys this year, the top handful of guys last year too. So it's kind of a false dichotomy. But I think what we have seen now is the evolution of this being an organization where you could look at the top 100 list and pick out the names with the word Orioles next to them. And that represented 90% of their prospect value, really. You know, there were some pitchers who didn't get, you know, who weren't in that mix, who have turned out to be better than people expected. But by and large, this was an organization who the top handful of picks every year were hitters, and those hitters were good and got to the big leagues quickly. And there is not a thing wrong with that. They were trying to turn the ship around as fast as possible. It worked out very well. What we have seen over the last year, especially with the deadline trades last year and a draft in which they had four of the top 30 some picks.
And as much money to spend as basically anybody.
Yeah, and a ton of money to spend. We have seen a broadening out of this system that has honestly been a long time coming. I think a couple of things have factored into that. The trades obviously helped. They are now 3 years into kind of this iteration of their pitching program, and I think it's really starting to click. You know, if I had a dollar for every time I said this was the year that it was going to start appearing at Camden Yards, I'd have like $4. So, you know, eventually it's going to happen. But this is a system that is much deeper than it has been. There were people who I went into this process thinking were slam dunks to me in the top 10 who were in the mid to late teens, because there's just not, you know, and it's not, you know, all these things end up being preference and splitting hairs. But in the past, I've had a lot of trouble in like the 8, 9, 10 range, because all of a sudden it just falls off. that fall off happened at like 17, 18, 19 this year. And I think, you know, it's at some point they were doing these, they were having their meetings in the offseason, the team, and they were just like, wait a second, we have 20 top 10 prospects. And it's like, because there's only 10, but you could put those 20 names, you know, outside the top two in basically any order and come up with a list that you weren't going to feel ashamed of.
I'll put it this way. Okay. Jerron Watts Brown, before they made the Boz trade, you know, if we go back, you know, to when they still had the Slater DeBruns and the Caden Bodines and all, but Michael Ferrett, but when they did, Jackson Watts Brown was 19 on this list. Levi Wells was 18. Those are guys who, like you said, it would not have been that long ago that you would have been thinking when you got to 9 or 10, like, yeah, okay, where does this guy fit? Now, even after this, they're still, you know, they're still in the middle of the teens, even after they traded away a significant number of prospects to bring back Shane Boz, you know, in the Shane Boz trade. But the other thing that stands out here, we'll get to some of these players, is they've also now started to have kind of those lower level, like you said, there. When Jackson Holiday emerges, when Gunnar Henderson emerges, Gunnar was not a first pick, but he was a well-paid supplemental. It wasn't something where it's like, wow, where did they find this guy? Nate George is, wow, where did they find this guy? You know, Esteban Mejia, Luis De Leon coming up. Not that those, again, were completely out of nowhere, but that's, again, that's not the same thing as we picked one, we picked two, we picked three, yeah, and we said, here, this, the top player in the draft is going to be our guy. There's a little bit more of that deepening of that. And that's like where I think the system is going to be really interesting this year, because you're going to see probably the top two, Bisaio and Beavers. If they don't, Beavers was right here about, you know, an inch from graduating last year. Bisaio, as you said, was very, very carefully done to make sure that he's still eligible, PPI pick and all.
Yeah.
But those guys are graduating. Trey Gibson is kind of their, I would say, probably closest, like, you know, prominent pitching prospect who might be the one who actually keeps you from getting that dollar next year of, you know, that, you know, the next year will be the year, because maybe he's the one, or maybe there's a couple other guys. But after that, I do feel like that there's a number of guys here who you could say, okay, some of the draft picks from last year, some of the guys who started to emerge last year, there's a lot of different paths to like who could be the top prospects in this organization a year from now, I feel like.
Yeah. And, you know, my mind, and this is very like Orioles coded, but I feel like even as all this stuff is happening, I have a weird feeling that one of the guys who are remaining from last year's draft from the first day, whether Ike Irish or Viva Loy, it seems like those are the types that they are going to. I just have a feeling that they're kind of, you can't say that an organization is due when, you know, basically their first day picks just shoot through the minors and like end up on top 100 picks or top 100 lists and top prospect lists. And it's been like 2 years since that happened, so they're due now. But I think I think those are archetypes and the types of players who can just go out and have one of those like Colton Cowser play three levels and put yourself on the map thing. There's so many options. All those pitchers you mentioned, you know, Nate George, if Nate George ends up in AAA and has any kind of season like he did this year, and he's still at that age, you're talking about somebody that's hard to view as anything other than an impact, you know, 5-tool outfielder. So there's just a ton of, I've done this exercise before and I'm hesitant to give out a name because I just forgot who I said, and I don't want to have,
I'll make the case for George. And yeah, not that, because just because I find him fascinating, right? And he is a fascinating, like a high school pick. Again, credit to scouting, development, all this, Nate George. But like, this is a later round. This is a day three pick out of high school. Not a whole lot of teams. There were teams on him, but not a ton. Orioles did a really good job also of being aware of kind of the signability there. Comes in and basically has one of those, where did this come from, seasons last year. There are a few players that I would say that I had more fun watching games of last year than Nate George. I was just telling you before we started here, I was going back and watching, you know, like hopped on Synergy, and it's like, there's the Nate George play where he hits the ball Hard hit grounder to the third baseman, and it hits off the third baseman and flies through the air, and the second baseman fields it and thinks about making a throw. Okay, that's one. That's an odd one. Then there's the next play not long after it where the shortstop goes two steps to his left, fields the ball cleanly, makes the throw, and Nate George beats it because Nate George not only can fly, is an eight runner at his best, but also gives you the hardest 90, you know, like you're ever going to see over and over and over, where you rarely see him not play basically as if he's playing his last game ever and he wants to make sure that he leaves it all on the field. That's kind of part of his, seems like his ethos. The interesting thing to see is like with him is he does not pull the ball in the air right now. Like his swing is very much, he's a right-handed hitter who at his best is lining the ball to right field or hitting the ball on the ground to the left side of the infield. But that, like, we'll have to see if that develops. But I will say, if you're going to be that kind of player and it doesn't develop, and he's very young, so it could, but if not, have these other skills, right? Like be a Justin Crawford type with the Phillies, who's going to be in the big leagues probably this year, where you're like, he does everything. He hits 320 every year at every level he goes. He can run. He can play in the outfield. He just can't hit for power. That's kind of like the Nate George, like it doesn't come together, is he runs really well. He'll fly around the outfield. He'll steal bases, although he does need to figure out sometimes yes, sometimes hold off a little bit.
Yeah.
I just find him fascinating. But again, he's one of like, we could have the same kind of conversation, like you said, about Ike Irish, who was one of the best hitters in the SEC last year. We could have this conversation about Luis De Leon, who is a really intriguing pitching prospect. We could have Esteban Mejia, who, I mean, has just the filthiest stuff out there if he could throw strikes.
He will be the top prospect at some point. if it clicks, like, and that was something that came up, and not to cut you off, that was something that came up in this process. It was like, you know, everything that was out there on him was real. It's just that you wait for it to kind of click. And like, once it does click, everyone's going to know, because it's going to happen. Like, he's going to be in the big leagues like that, you know? And I think there was an interest, at least internally, of like making sure it was kind of apparent that was not going to happen. And, you know, in May, and as is their right.
He was in low A.
Yeah. As is their right.
He was in rookie ball at that time, I guess. Cause Josh saw for us in the complex league, I want to say in May.
Yeah. And you know, he's not, you know, I'm fascinated to see how they handle it. I can't imagine he's going to pitch more than once a week. He pitched 50 innings last year, and you're still trying to scale that, but you don't take that kind of skill set lightly. And just the fact that we're having this conversation about how many different, you know, archetypes, profiles, versus like this guy was a first day shortstop who hits the ball really hard. This guy was a first day outfielder who hits the ball really hard. He was a great college player, and he's going to be on the Orioles in an hour and a half. Like, just the fact that we're not having that conversation, we're having a conversation about such a vast kind of swath of talent. It really speaks to, you know, it speaks to a lot of the evolution that's happened around here.
The other thing I'll say is, and it has to, because the other thing that's true here, I know they had a down year last year, but this is not a team that should be picking 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 anytime again soon. So you don't get to say, okay, we think that Adley Rutschman is clearly the number one pick. You know, Rock Chulowski is really good. The Orioles aren't going to have a chance to get Rock Chulowski. You know, this is not the team of a few years ago that way. I did want to ask about one other guy because when we talk about like the logjam at the upper levels, it's kind of lessened a little bit. It's more of the guys who've already graduated, but there is one exception to that, which is I would assume that Enrique Bradfield starts the year at AAA, and where it gets tough is finding how he fits. Now, obviously the great thing for him is a little different skill set than most of their other outfielders, but is this probably a whole another year at AAA for him, barring injury, or how do you think it could kind of filter out?
I think that there's an opportunity for him to come up at some point this year. I definitely don't think he's going to get the Ryan Mountcastle 2019. Like, you are going to play every single day of the season in AAA, and we'll talk to you in October. it's going to be really fascinating because it is such a unique skill set. If this team is where they want to be towards the end of the season, there's no one else that can do what he can in a you know, even a bench like late game role. Their outfield doesn't make a ton of sense now looking at it in April, but it also doesn't matter who's going to come off the bench as a defensive replacement in, you know, sitting here in spring training. But like, he would be such an asset to have, and he is somebody who I felt weird about having ranked lower this year than last year. He is somebody who has done exactly what he's been asked to do. He is improving the things that need to be improved on, you know, significantly. This kind of goes back to the, you know, is the catcher getting better behind the plate thing? Like, of course they're getting better. Is there getting better for enough for it to matter? That's another question. But his ground ball rate falls every year. He's hitting the ball, you know, on a line over the infield more often. That's exactly what you need to do, because even as fast as him, you can't just hit the ball on the ground and beat it out. Once you get into the high minors and the big leagues, there's guys who are able to field that ball and throw you out. But I think the Orioles have a very high opinion of his potential value. You know, Jorge Mateo was on this team for years because he played really good shortstop defense in their estimation and could steal bases, and he would hit for like 3 weeks out of every year, and that would be kind of the dream he'd hold on to. But at its best, that was a valuable player for the Orioles. They understand that profile can be valuable. I think Enrique Bradfield Jr. is going to be better than Jorge Mateo, but I think every time I wonder how is this going to work, I remember that they have found a way to keep a player who can do the things that Enrique Bradfield does really well on the roster because they think it matters. And that's kind of how I've always had to frame this.
Right. Again, like you said, if they're in the playoff hunt, it's hard to imagine him not on the playoff roster because his ability to pinch run and then also stay in as a defensive replacement if they've got the lead is valuable enough. Now the question is how does he carve a path to regular, you know, being a regular? That's a different story maybe, but he has a very unique skill set. That is an eight runner who can steal bases and can also give you exceptional outfield defense. Not a bad combo to have.
He could be like, you know, when he was first coming up after his first draft year, you know, everyone's sitting around during BP in Aberdeen, I believe. And someone was like, he's going to be like a two-win player that you're like, how did this even happen? Like, you're watching him on a daily basis and you're looking at his, you know, Fangraphs page and you're like, what's going on here? But he's making an impact and there's value. And like, that would be, you know, I'm sure the Orioles would take that. I'm sure he would take that. I'm sure there's nobody's giving up on the offensive impact, but he can make an impact in so many other ways.
I know Pete Crow Armstrong has way more power, but look at what Pete Crow Armstrong's year last year was with the power, but also a ton of strikes outs, not a great batting average, not a great on-base percentage, but just look at how much defensive value he gave the Cubs. It's hard for me not to look at that. Like, if you are this good a defender, look at what Sedan Rafaela has done, you know, for the Red Sox. If you're this good a defender in center, the bar offensively is not nearly as high to produce real value. So
yeah,
it'll be fun to watch. But well, that's going to end the video portion of this on the YouTube side. But if you want to see more, if you're on the podcast side, stick around. But if you're not, go check out the podcast feed, because we're going to dive into some, we said this is a really deep system. After this break, we're going to look at guys outside of the top 10. So John, looking past the top 10, like we said, this is a list past the top 10 that would be guys who would have been in many cases at the back of the 10 last year. Who are a couple of guys who stand out to you that you're kind of like, oh, when you're writing them up, you're like, wow, this guy's not a top 10 prospect here?
Yeah, gosh, Boston Bateman. That was an easy one. There wasn't, you know, you get bored at games in like August and you're sitting there behind home plate and you don't want to watch anymore. You don't want to take any notes and you start just writing down every name in the system you're going to rank. And he was always in the top 10 in that, you know, I like to tear guys out. And he was always in that mix for me. And it kind of became clear that other guys just were viewed in higher esteem than him. And these things happen. But one of the things that is tricky about kind of evaluating him and seeing him is that, you know, he made significant gains from being drafted by the Padres to being traded by the Orioles, in terms of velocity, in terms of pitchability. There was a lot of stuff that I think the Orioles picked up on and were like, this is a pretty rare combination of, you know, age, even though he's massive, projectability, stuff, you know, velocity from the left side for a teenager. And they obviously pounced on that. And then he comes over in the trade and he looks like somebody who's in the last month of his first full season of professional baseball. It's really hard to, you know, hold your velocity for that long. You show me a high school drafty pitcher and I'll show you somebody who gets tired in August. And I think, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I don't think I underranked him. I think that was like a little splash of cold water on the Boston Bateman buzz that kind of built around the trade. But the idea that he's not in the top 10 prospects, given he was probably the best player they acquired in any of those trades, felt very strange to me. I don't think it says anything about him and his prospects. You know, he's going to be somebody I'm very interested to see with a full offseason, with a year working with the Orioles pitching program, in developing, you know, a couple, you know, I'm sure he's going to end up throwing like three more pitches than he did this time last year, because that's kind of how they do. Yeah, they're just, you know, these guys get the high end. It's like, cool, you now throw a splitter and a cutter. Here you go. Well, and once you master them, you can leave. So I'm really fascinated to see him. I think Jaron Watts Brown was another interesting one who you kind of brought up. I mean, that is a big league slider if I've ever seen one in my life. And the last one I would flag is Aaron Estrada, who's doing things, you know, on the infield, at least as a hitter, that are the types of things that get prospects ranked highly. And you know, he is somebody who we could be sitting here around the All-Star break and he could be in AAA already and like having put up like a 900 OPS in AA, and everyone's saying, what is this? Like, excuse me, it's probably second base only. I know, but it's a switch hit, like high contact profile, hits a lot of line drives. It'll be stretched because it's hard to play only second base. But there is a lot of offensive promise there.
Right. Especially it'll be stretched because it's only second base, and almost everyone who's only second base is the guy who has to work hard to stay at second base, because the reason that you're only second base is because they're like, can you play third? No. Can you play short? No. Can you play second? Yeah. You know, but
yeah.
And I love the bat.
They're running him around in the outfield, and you know, that's not exactly like a land of opportunity where the Orioles are concerned anyways. But you know, if I got any feedback, you know, you've done this long enough, you know, you get some feedback and some things they don't tell you, but one thing, you know, and I always take it into consideration what they do tell me. It's like, man, Estrada not in the top 10. It's like, I don't understand. I told you guys, and you know, I split up my calls between like, here's the guys that could be in the top 10 and here's the guys that probably won't be. And he was always, I prefaced every single person I talked to inside and outside the organization, I want to put this guy in the top 10. I don't know how I'm going to be able to do it. I don't think I can, but like, again, sitting there in August, I'm like, dude, like, this is a really good hitter. Like, I know what I'm seeing is there. I know I'm seeing something. I want to do it. And I just couldn't pull the trigger.
The struggle is to me, cause he's 11 and Aloy was 9, and Estrada's a better hitter. I really think that Estrada's a better hitter, yeah. But then you've got a true shortstop. And when you've got like, that's where, again, that's why this is fun, right? Is that there is no right answer to that. Cause it's like, do you like the guy who's a second baseman, who's a better hitter, or do you like the guy who's a true shortstop and let's see how his bat develops? And by the way, when I say true shortstop, let's see how his bat develops. This isn't Griffo Farrell either. This isn't a guy who you're like, he's a shortstop. How is he going to hit? Oh, don't worry about that. You know, we just want him to play defense. This is a guy who was solid in the SEC, but now it's like, okay, can he find another gear? The trade deadline really did bulk between that and the draft, because you hit on those guys. We could spend time talking about Wilfie De La Cruz. I think Anthony Nunez will pitch in the big leagues at this year and help in the bullpen. This is a guy, fascinating story, because he was a guy who was a legitimate drafted position player, failed. And you're like, oh, so they converted him to reliever? That? No. Then he went back to college, because you can go back to play D2, you know, if you were drafted, and then comes back as a pitcher. That is not a path that you see very often. He will probably hit the big leagues. And then you got the the interesting international signings who've kind of taken steps forward, like the, you know, the Hidalgos and all, where this list, I feel like is, I would say that this list remains fascinating. Well, I would say even the back of it, Vance Honeycutt's at the very back of this list. And that's one where you say he should be at the back of the list. That was a terrible season. But I will also say that is something where when you look at the defense, when you look at the athleticism, if they can fix the hit tool, which is the biggest if, I mean, that's a massive if.
It's a big if.
But if they somehow did, that to have that guy be 28 one year after he was top 10, even after admittedly a really bad strikeout rates and all this, I feel like there's not a lot of guys in this list, even if you get down to 30, where you're like, it's kind of just a generic guy that there's nothing really that interesting about.
Yeah. And there were pitchers that, you know, and I've kind of learned the cadence of how, you know, basically like every pitcher they draft the next year, their first full season, they all pitch like 75 innings and strike out like 10 and a half guys per nine and are completely indistinguishable and unremarkable. And I've tried to get a couple of those pitchers onto the back end of the list, knowing that the next year they're going to show up with two new pitches and start striking the world out. But it's, you know, the back end of this list, as you mentioned, and I think there's a through line here, so I just want to flag this. So we're talking about Vihi Valoi, Hike Irish, Vance Honeycutt, all very different players. The Orioles played in Aberdeen as their high A affiliate for a long time. It was a graveyard. I know you guys do all the park effect stuff and it does it justice, but it is a miserable place for hitters to hit. You basically have to hit tanks down the line to get it out. Everything in the gaps dies. You know, guys have really been impacted by playing there. They're moving to Frederick, same league, but so they're going to have to face, you know, prospects from the Rays and the Yankees and the Mets and the Phillies. It's a very good league for pitchers, but the Orioles hitters moving from Aberdeen to Frederick is going to make such a difference. Vance Honeycutt could just show up and make a little more contact and have a lot more production. You know, somebody like Vihi Valoi, his raw power, which is, you know, they took batting practice on the field at Camden Yards and the Pirates were in town and O'Neill Cruz was literally hitting the ball off the warehouse, but Vihi Valoi was also,
yeah, become my new standard after the home run derby last year, the All-Star game, where I'm like, okay, Joey Gallo has now been topped for me as far as the longest home run I've ever seen.
Yeah, no, hitting the ball off the warehouse during BP, it was amazing. But Vihi Valoi was also out there like hitting the ball really hard. You know, all these guys are going to, it's going to look so much better. I'm not, you know, it's going to be a challenge for me as somebody who has to kind of like filter this out to say like what's real, what's not. But there's going to be a perception that a lot of these guys take a huge step forward. And I think Aloy is a really interesting one in that sense, because we're talking about Enrique Bradfield and even Nate George of like finding guys' swing adjustments to get them a little more slug and tap into their contact ability and enhance what's deficient on those high contact, low whiff guys. Where they have had a little more struggles is the guys who hit the snot out of the ball and don't make as much contact as you want. Judd Fabian has made it pretty far. I'm not closing the book on that forever, but you know, it's a hard thing to do. We obviously saw what happened with Vance Honeycutt, but I think if there is a world where they do that with Vihi Valoi, it's going to look like something that is pretty remarkable is happening in Frederick this year.
That's a great thing to kind of, to as we wrap this up, to kind of note, which is that that is going to be a very significant change. And that will be something, again, it's something where it's subtle, but it's also not, because I know that we are now in an era where teams are analyzing players on much more than the slash line. At the same time, it does not matter how much a player is told, hey, by the way, you know, your expected WOBA is way higher than what your actual numbers are here because of the park. It still messes with you. You know, you don't want to go up there. It's like, wait, that says 183, you know, 290. That's terrible. I've never hit like that before.
Yeah. And you know, and that is a hard league to hit in, period. I mean, you're basically, if you stacked up like other than like, you know, the teams are on the West Coast and wouldn't be in that league. Like, there's a lot of teams that do pitching really, really well in that league. Like you see things there that you don't see in the, even like in the SEC, like you're just wearing it every single day. And I think there's a lot that's grinded on these guys, and the fact that they don't have to hit an Aberdeen anymore. I'm honestly like, I've been trying to prepare people for it. I think it's going to be kind of crazy.
But that's the perfect way to wrap it up. Thank you for the time, John. Thank you for the listen, everyone listening. And please like and subscribe. Leave a review. It does help other people discover us. And obviously, if you enjoyed this, check out baseballamerica.com and also the Baltimore Banner, where John is a columnist. Because, you know, we love covering all 30 teams, and we like to give you deep insights on all of them. Having, you know, connections and working with people like John helps us do that. For John, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.